Yeah, there it is. When that robot voice comes in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
ELB.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks and sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you're working through that Easter candy. Maybe you're lying on the couch, just sitting in the dark, wallowing in your own sugar high. Whatever the case, we're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free, thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. They bring the show to you. Their generosity, their support, their belief in what we're doing over here means we get to keep doing it. And boy, are we grateful. In exchange, they get some cool perks, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, and a bevy of bonus content, extra stuff, extra episodes. Feeling This with Alex Solman and Christian Spicer. You got the DLC Book Club. You got your spoiler chats, your bonus audio, and the Wednesday paid DLC program every single midweek. It's your midweek pick-you-up. That's what we like to call it, where the patrons get to interact with us. We interact with them. It's so much fun. All of it available only for people that support the show at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the only show. The only show. It's the main show. It's the show all about games in their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, that's spelled with two N's and one T, and I am joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis. The guy who gets all his news on April 1st, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian!
It's the worst day on the internet. You can't believe what you read unless it's from your uncle, then it's true, and that's sad.
You missed the easy rhyme there. You said it's a bad day on the internet. You aren't going to believe what you're going to get. No? Okay.
I never take the easy rhyme, Jeff. I don't do a limerick every week. I just say stuff. And for the record, fair. I have the light on as I'm eating my shame candy. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, either way, whatever works for you. You know, whatever intensifies the shame. Hey, we got an awesome show for you this week, ladies and gentlemen. We got some pretty cool news, some big game reveals, some interesting stuff. You know, E3 was always a feeling. Now it's all year round. We get cool game reveals all year round. Anyway, we got lots to talk about. We got some cool games to chat about in the playlist, and we have an awesome guest to do all of that with. You know that DLC always stands for your downloadable Cannata and your downloadable Christian, but this week, I'm excited because DLC stands for dedication. That's a little crazy, because from Irrational Passions, as well as IGN, it's Jarrett Green joining us for the first time. Hey, Jarrett.
Hello. Allow me to congratulate and compliment on the absolute insane drop that hit my ears out of nowhere. And now suddenly I want to run through a brick wall.
It sounds a little bit like we got the AI version of Jarrett Green on the line, but I
yes, it's OpenAI sponsored this message.
Excited to have you. We had actually a couple of listeners write in and suggest your name to be on the show, and I was so delighted that you said yes. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, and thank you, anonymous listeners who believed that me and OpenAI should join this show this weekend.
Well, let's jump in and start the show the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. That's also where you can send comments, questions, parting gifts, anything you'd like us to know. We certainly love hearing from you over there at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. But it's not the only way. You can also check out our Discord, which is 5x5 DLC on Discord. Lots of cool folks hanging out, talking about games and all sorts of other stuff. Urge you to take part. It's a great community. Join it. Be part of it. But Jarrett, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Let's see. I think the story that maybe speaks to me directly is that after, I guess, real decades, Hellgate London is getting a sequel.
Wow. I'm shocked. I thought I was the only one that was going to care about that story, but I'm delighted to hear that you're excited.
It's the worst day for this news to come out, by the
way.
I
know, right? Like, it feels like an April Fool's story. It really does.
100%.
Hellgate London, by no means a hit.
No.
In 2007, I believe it came out. This was Bill Roper's attempt at the looter shooter before we had that term. It was a third-person action-adventure game with a really interesting progression system, loot system. It did not do particularly well, but we just got news this week that Bill Roper is coming back. He has got into an agreement with Lunacy Games, which was just recently founded, to make a follow-up to this this kind of beloved franchise that he always said he wanted to return to, and it's going to be called Hellgate Redemption. He says it's happening. You know, this is just early in development, so we don't have any kind of release date or anything. But I'm so curious, Jarrett, your history with Hellgate London, the first game, and why you're excited to hear this.
Now, I don't remember. Specifically, I know that I probably did not play this when it launched, which was like Halloween.
Yeah.
2007, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think I played it till the year after. Probably procured it illegally, allegedly. But I remember it as like an attempt to 3D-ify, maybe Diablo. That's kind of like my strongest memories of it is like the combat. It was 3D. It was like over the shoulder, kind of third person, first person E. The combat was like kind of undercooked in the same way that you can kind of get away with that in a CRPG, but you could not get away with that here. People kind of expected more in 2007 at that point.
Yeah.
But the looter shootery, it felt like that thing that kind of wrapped their hands around people when it came to Destiny in like 2013. It was already starting that, right? It was already.
Yeah.
And I remember that was the thing that kind of wrap me in that. In the setting, I thought was kind of cool, like Doom had happened, but like in the middle of London.
Nobody
liked this game. I don't remember none of the people that I know personally who ever played it walked away from it feeling very fondly about it. So this is like a thing that I just kind of liked for, I don't know, 15-20 years before I realized other people did too.
Yeah.
In any particular way. So and I never thought I'd ever see a sequel. Like no one has ever like cried for a sequel to a game less than for Hellgate London,
right.
But I am pleasantly surprised that it's happening.
It's a wild thing to read. Christian, I was thinking to myself, if I had by some kind of strange stroke of lightning said that my Cool Ranch prediction for 2024 was going to be that there was going to be a sequel to Hellgate London, I would have been laughed out of the podcast. And no one had this on their bingo card. Jared is absolutely right. This game, very few people even have a fond remembrance of, because it didn't do well at the time. So, you know, Bill Roper, if folks listening aren't particularly aware of him, he was kind of one of the guiding designers of the original Diablo and the original StarCraft and one of, you know, Blizzard's kind of, top tier producer designers in that early era of those Blizzard hits. And then he peeled off and started his own thing. And his first game, I believe, as a independent developer was Hellgate London. And Jarrett is absolutely right. It was really touted as like, what if Diablo, but in 3D, which at that time was a big deal. And it did not do great. There was not a lot to do in the game when it launched, and it had all these lofty promises, and it kind of, it didn't really, you know, I don't think it really fulfilled its promises, but it did have a cool premise. It was this sort of steampunky kind of Victorian London, but with demons popping out of hell holes and things. And you would go into the sewers and, you know, it was kind of not modern day, but it was more modern than you usually get. It's not, it wasn't, you know, sort of Tolkien-esque fantasy settings. And it had, you know, top hats and kind of cool looks to it. And, I thought it always had potential. And it's really interesting to think that Roper has had that thought for this whole time and now is going to have the means and opportunity to take another swing at this franchise. Hellgate Redemption evidently is being built on Unreal Engine 5 and will be coming for PCs and consoles. Christian, do you have any memory of Hellgate London?
I remember it at the time, or from the time of, oh God, when did the first Dead Space come out? But there was this era of everything was an IP. And I remember even Hellgate London being, but there was a time of like Hellgate London. This is clearly not, it's not Hellgate, right? Like there's others. This world.
Yeah, right.
And if memory serves, there was a Dark Horse comic. Oh God. Mad Cow or Dark Horse comic. I think
that's right. Yeah.
Books too. Like this was
in the era of everything is pan media.
That's a better way to put it than, that's why I was like Dead Space, you know, had that launch. And then also Dante's Inferno was one of those of like, this isn't just a game. And a lot of them, maybe it's just the early aughts. It's like Hellgate London, Dead Space, Dante's Inferno. Like we were just dark, you know, baggy pants. Yeah. Bad attitudes. But that's what I remember about Hellgate London was it was this ambitious swing of the time of it was going to be everything. It was bigger than just a video game, you know, kind of the first real run at video games pounding their chests and being like, pay attention to us. We're not the Super Mario Brothers Super Show anymore. Like we're edgy, we're dark, we have this. And that's what I remember of the game. And I think I played it at a friend's house and it was just like we had it and you know it kind of bounced off of it, but I remember thinking the box art just I could look it up, I don't need to ask you all, but in my head it was like just what's it called, like the demonic
I think it was just a big like summoning circle,
yeah,
big
yeah,
fire red, over like the London Bridge or something.
It was
intense.
evidently it was re-released on Steam back in 2018. This is news to me, but they did put out a version of it on Steam of Hellgate London on Steam in 2018. So I guess there has been some momentum that I may not have been aware of.
So I do remember this happening, and the I guess kind of fun coincidence of that is a game like Dragon's Dogma had a similar sort of trajectory, right? Like it launched, no one really understood it.
Right.
I think it got, Dragon's Dogma got better received in 2011 than Hellgate London did in 2007. But after that initial launch cycle, people were like, I don't know what this is, and kind of just bounced off it. Partially because Dark Souls came out, you know, 9 months before that, and everybody was still being blown away by that. It launches, the Dark Arisen expansion gets released on Steam in 2016. And that's really when the big spike of like the cult following becomes sort of unmasked. They become public. It's not just, you know, freaks like me who actually like that game. Now people are watching it. People can actually play it again on a modern console, or I guess modern PCs with modern hardware. The game doesn't run as bad anymore. So like, then, you know, Twitch happens and you can like see people play it and mm-hmm. and that's how you gain a following. Hellgate London had a similar trajectory. It got re-released. People started playing it and still didn't like it in 2018. So it never got that, second redemption tour. So it's very interesting to, in a time when it's difficult to get like new things made, it is very interesting that someone found money, time, and an interest in will from an investor to let someone try this again.
Yeah.
Because it's very rare.
It is indeed. It is indeed. It's going to be interesting to see how this turns out and if it has – I mean, I think certainly the market has shifted, and I think people are more accustomed to these types of games. You know, as we already pointed out, there's already a whole subgenre of this type of thing. And, you know, if the game looks real pretty in Unreal Engine 5 and Roper kind of is back to his old mojo of making, you know, addictive gameplay loops, maybe this could be great. It is a bummer. I like how you guys pointed out that it was Hellgate London. You would assume the next game, if there was a next game, would be Hellgate, you know, Paris or Hellgate Tokyo or something.
Well, I think this is just its code name, Redemption. I don't think it's like an official. I mean, at this point, it probably will be, because like this is just a working title, and then everybody knows it by that. So like, well, let's keep the working title that everybody knows.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Redemption has a lot of you know, layered meanings to it. We're going to redeem this game that nobody particularly liked when it came out.
How just ahead of its time it was. I looked it up, so it was October, as Jared mentioned, Halloween 2007, Dead Space was 2008, mm-hmm, with all of its accoutrement, video game, movie, comic books, and then Dante's Inferno was 2010. And so I feel like there was just this trajectory of it's going to be pan media, we're going to release these things, it's going to be bigger than just a game that, you know, you buy at GameStop or do something with. And, you know, Hellgate London just didn't quite hit the mark, but it was on that path for sure.
Yeah. Well, Roper, I've never met him, but I've heard is a really nice guy. So I'm rooting for this. I'm rooting for him. I'm rooting for this. It feels like a passion project, you know. Redemption. He wants to redeem this idea he had, and you know, hopefully this all works out. Well, probably won't hear more about this for, you know, a year or two at the minimum. But I'm going to keep my ears peeled for more Hellgate Redemption news, because I'm rooting for this one. Very cool. Very cool story. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
I have a pitch. Okay. It's just stay with me. This is wild. You're not going to talk about getting money for a game. What if Overwatch?
Yeah. But, yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. It's like, it's Overwatch, but DC characters.
I don't know if I'm interested, I'll be honest.
Okay, what about Marvel characters?
Now I'm interested. Now I want that game. What's it called?
Yes. Okay. Well, I was thinking about like something that tells people what it is, and it's like Marvel characters who are antagonists of one another.
Mm, that rolls off the tongue. It's good.
Okay, but they're all Marvel rivals. That's what I'll call it. I'll call it Marvel rivals. It got teased very soon before it got officially unveiled with a flashy trailer, and you can sign up to join the alpha, I think is what this first kind of public release of it is going to be. Since it got released or announced, I should say, there have been people being dumb with NDAs and leaking gameplay that clearly has their player name watermarked on it, of like an early demo, or I guess a pre-alpha test of the game. And it is, you know, whatever, it looks Overwatchy, it looks a little Valorant-y, but probably closer in speed to Overwatch. And I'm saying Overwatch, not Overwatch 2. It's 6v6, which is what Overwatch 1 was. Team-based hero shooter where you are the Marvel heroes, not B heroes, not heroes you haven't really heard of. It's Spider-Man, Iron Man, Hulk.
I mean, there's Magic, some heroes you've never heard of. Let's be honest.
Well, I feel like Marvel keeps trying to make Magic a thing, which I'm there for. Magic was in Midnight Suns, I believe. Yeah.
Penny Parker. I don't think most people know who Penny Parker is.
Yeah, well, Penny Parker is Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think most people know who she is.
Well, you need a diva character, Jeff. What are you
saying? I'm just saying they're not all, household names.
All marquees. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But there's Rocket Raccoon. There's Groot. There's Magneto, I think they showed in the trailer as well. Like, it's got big names up front, and it's free to play. NetEase I'm very curious how this game hits. And more importantly, Jared, I'm very curious how this game monetizes. That's my question.
That is like, that's why this exists, right? Because I don't think anyone, when you ask anyone, like, I think everyone agrees Marvel Heroes in a video game. All right, we're cooking a little bit. We're on the right path. Yeah. No one would ever describe this as the game they want, though.
And it is third person. I left that out. It is third.
Yeah, it is third person. Yeah. But like these sort of multiplayer, live servicey, easily monetizable things has not, like, traditionally not really done well as far as, like, I guess critical reception is concerned. I'm sure a lot of the stuff that ends up on like mobile, all the Marvel license stuff there probably does pretty well, because why would they still continue to do this, right? But I don't know anyone who asked for Marvel and Overwatch. I feel like the most constant thing I hear when people are like, I would like to see another Marvel game, is like another X-Men Legends or another Ultimate Alliance, or like, yeah, I don't know, something like that. That does not mean I wouldn't sign up and attempt and, you know, try this, but I know I don't see myself playing much of this game.
I'm gonna present the exact same opinion and come to the opposite conclusion. I agree with you 100%, Jared, that this is not, if you ask me, like, you got the Marvel Hero IP, what are you going to do with it? This is way down on my list of options, right? This isn't the first thing I'm going to go to. That said, I'm pretty excited about this, and it will get me to play a game like this. Like, I don't want this type of game, isn't at the top of my list of what I want, but because it's got the Marvel license, maybe I will want it. I feel like I will get to the point where this will make me play this way more than Overwatch would get me to play Overwatch. And the reasons are twofold. Not only because I'm just a sucker for Marvel characters, which I am, and I would cop to that right now, but secondly, the moment I was sitting there at BlizzCon, the moment they announced Overwatch, the very first thing I said to myself was, I wish this was third person. I just want to be able to look at the cool characters. And especially if the way you're going to monetize this is look at how cool your character can look in all the various ways, which side point is, that's very difficult to do with Marvel characters. It's hard to put fun hats and pants and goggles on them because you don't want the Hulk to look like a goofball. You want him to look like the Hulk.
No one wants Scarlet Spider's outfit. Sorry, Ben. No one wants the Scarlet Spider costume. No one wants it.
The cutoff jean vest or whatever.
I mean, you know, I guess Insomniac figured out a way to make different costumes cool, but I find it hard to
imagine. Yeah, you don't pay money for them. You don't pay money for Insomniac's costumes.
The real irony of our first two stories is that Bill Roper ran into this exact problem in another project he worked on, which was that Marvel Diablo game. What was that called, Christian?
Marvel Heroes?
Heroes, yes.
Yeah, I was just talking about that, Jared. Yeah. So they had the same problem where it's like, get cool gear for your Marvel Heroes. It's like, well, I guess it's cool to have the numbers go up, but I want, you know, that's not the reason I like cool gear. It's part of the reason, but the most of the reason is so my character can look neat. And I don't want, like I said, I don't want the Hulk to wear a shirt. Don't wear a shirt ever. So I don't want to add shirt to my character, you know? Anyway, that's a completely tangential point, but
I think it's important because that is how this monetizes, right? Like, I mean, we're speculating at this point. They haven't revealed the season pass or the battle pass or anything like that, but it is a free-to-play game with a very expensive license attached to it. It needs to make money somehow, and I feel like what you're suggesting is the way that they have it planned, because if they sell characters, that creates imbalance, and Overwatch 2 has recently even walked that back the way they were doing and is still trying to maintain balance, but selling characters. I feel like it's difficult to do well. That does not mean I don't think this game will make all the money, but I think it's difficult to do well.
How do they make all the money? That's the question that we all have. And
right.
I don't know
how much of that money up front and how long can it make all that money?
Right. Yes. I do think just purely on a, I watched a video and I saw Doctor Strange go through a portal, fighting other Marvel heroes. I am like jazzed about this game. I am super into it. All those questions are big questions.
I think though, like you said, the Marvel license is kind of the biggest reason why I would try this, right? Like,
yeah.
Outside of the team shootery, whatever. Also, I guess to the beginning joke, it is funny how like the relationship between DC and Marvel's like just licensing is like sexual harassment versus flirting, like that little meme. But I'm a pretty big I play a lot of Predecessor. Mm-hmm. I played a lot of Paragon before it. Play a little bit of Smite. Like these third person sort of MOBA-y team shootery kind of situations.
Yeah.
Are games I kind of play. I don't play Overwatch, but I can see a world where having something like Predecessor, but with characters you recognize and licensing that you and branding that you can already have a connection with. Like really, really works where something like this is kind of starting from the mud. You're already starting from wherever the MCU is now in the zeitgeist. It's probably a little lower than it was, 5 years ago, but still pretty big.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people at least shared that opinion that it's Doctor Strange is on it. Magneto's here. I guess I'll try it. Yeah. I don't know how that looks in 6 months afterwards, but you know, I don't need to speculate. I'm going to be there probably.
Yeah.
Well, I think the PvP they've announced or said so far that it's just PvP. There's no PvE plans for it yet. And again, I keep going back to Overwatch. Overwatch 2 recently also seemingly eliminated its PvE entirely. They originally had big plans for PvE as part of Overwatch 2, and as Blizzard has changed and reorged and Overwatch 2 has changed over time, those plans have been scrapped. And I'm curious, kind of like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, Jeff, with Multiverses getting its official 1.0 release date, how many people you can create that sticky relationship with to have them keep coming back to a thing when what the thing they're playing is, Janet in Minnesota who keeps killing me every 4 seconds, or Billy, who's 7 and keeps killing me every 4 seconds. Like, how do you keep me engaged in that progression loop when it doesn't have Fortnite's other stuff to do and it's just this hero shooter? I'm very curious how that succeeds with a license like the Marvel license draining money from them, how it succeeds monetarily.
Yeah. I mean, I think Jarrett's right. I think this game is going to be huge for at least, a couple, 3 weeks, because everybody's going to want to give it a shot. And whether they can retain that and keep it moving and keep it going, that's the question, and I don't know the answer. We're going to find out a lot more information about this game, but I think it's coming relatively soon, right? Did they mention a release date? I don't have it here.
I think they said the alpha is like very May. Soon. It was like sign up now for the alpha. Yeah. And yeah, it looks pretty. Yeah. I mean, it has a unique art style that I think is pretty interesting. It's kind of Overwatchy, but very defined character silhouettes, which I think is important in these style of games, because otherwise Magneto can look a lot like Doctor Strange. One character can look, another Hulk can look like Juggernaut from far away as you're trying to identify who's what. But I think it's interesting.
Yeah, and Jarrett, you mentioned Marvel Ultimate Alliance. One of the key features of that game looks like they're kind of leveraging or lifting for this game, which is that team up thing where different characters can activate their powers at the same time, and then, or at least it looked that way from the Groot and Rocket Raccoon team up. But maybe that's just unique to those two because they're already a partnership. But it looked like there was this kind of team thing.
I do wonder about that because it did seem to at least imply that is a thing.
Yeah.
That's not really a thing in Overwatch. I don't know that there is really – I can't think of like something in that genre that does anything like that. So that could be like mechanically the thing that sets it apart.
Yeah.
And it's a good opportunity to really test Marvel fans' knowledge of these things. Cause I saw the one image of the Hulk, like shooting a beam out of his fists, and people are like, that's not a Hulk power. And I was like, well, actually, you know, I was just really annoying about it. And that's a good opportunity for me too. So
I love it. Well, that's Marvel Rivals, which just rolls off the tongue. Marvel's Rivals Arrival will be eventual. I'm going to go into my story of the week in just a moment after this word from our sponsor. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Raycon. Christian, what do you do all day long?
Stare into the darkness.
Yeah, but other than that.
So many things, Jeff. I think, well, one, I talk about how I use my Raycon when I take my dog on a walk, right? Plug them in, go out, listen to podcasts. But
yeah, it's weird for the dog, though. Dude, she's constantly...
She loves it.
She's like, why are you jamming? What are you jamming into?
We're walking like we're in a musical, you know, like da 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 da. Raycon everyday earbuds. I'm a la la land across the intersection. She's like, there's cars coming, bro. Keep moving. But recently there has been there are a few celebrities that I like go gaga for. Keanu Reeves was in my hood. A couple of times.
Okay. You dropped something and it's not the earbuds. It's your
name. No, they stay in. They fit really snug. They're really great. I'm not the type of person that goes out to coffee. I don't go out to coffee, but he's been out of coffee shop a couple of times. So I'm like, guess what old Christian Spicer's doing?
Got a plugging little hankering in for some coffee all of a sudden.
I'm like, you know what? I could listen to this audiobook that I really need to listen to. I should probably go for a walk. Where am I going to go? Well, I've got my Raycon Everyday earbuds in. And I'm like, my dog's like, are we going on a walk? I'm like, no, you already had yours. This is Dad's walk. We're going to go get coffee. I'm just listening to the Microsoft Cyberpunk keynote presentation over and over again and hearing Keanu's voice in my head through my Raycon Everyday earbuds as I go out to get my coffee and see if he's there. I have not seen him yet. I'll tell you what.
You're really just hoping it'll happen? That's hilarious.
It's happened so many times when I'm not there. And I'm not a stalker, so I'm not just staying there. I just walk and back.
That doesn't sound like stalkery activity at all.
Look, and hey, if the earbuds are running out of battery, I put them back in the case. They charge right back up again. Guess who's going back to get another coffee?
Well, Raycon offers amazing audio at half the price of other premium audio brands. You don't have to believe us. Talk about tens of thousands of five-star reviews. Yeah, Raycon has those. Raycon's optimized gel tips are designed to fit comfortably in your ears to actually stay there. So you don't have an awkward moment in front of Keanu. You don't want that. When you're like, I'm not worthy. And you're bowing your head really vociferously. You don't want the Raycons to fall out, you know,
in an awareness mode. So I can hear him if he's trying to sneak up behind me, cause he's trying to say hi to me, you know, like that's
how your relationship is in your imagination. Your Raycons can go with you everywhere with 8 hours of playtime and a 32 hour battery life. You don't have to worry about whether they're up for the task. They have three customizable sound profiles, the earbud tap functions, which I know Christian, you like, cause you got one hand on that dog leash most of the time. Noise isolation and awareness mode. The awareness mode, so key to have, because you don't want Keanu to, you know, say something and you miss it. You don't want to miss that. Mm-mm. Go to buyraycon.com/DLC today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/DLC. That's buyraycon.com/DLC. All right. You know, I could talk about some more Embracer Group divestments and millions of dollars for Gearbox. We've done enough of those kinds of stories. I want to talk about some more fun stuff because we're having a fun time so far of, you know, unexpected things. Maybe some expected things, maybe some glimpses at the future. And we got more information about a game that has been very much on my radar for quite some time. as somebody that still has the original BioShock in my top whatever of all time games. I do think it's one of those Pantheon games for me. And, you know, big fan of Ken Levine and what he does or has done as a game designer, although it's been quite a while since we got a Ken Levine joint. He's been working on this game, Judas, for quite some time. And we got some more information about it this week. A couple of very select individuals, a friend of the show, Jeff Keighley, and also some of your colleagues over at IGN, Jarrett, got a chance to get some hands-on for several hours with an early build of Judas, sitting next to Levine, evidently. And were able to share their thoughts and impressions of that early bit of gameplay. What we heard about Judas is that it's very much BioShock in that BioShock vein, in the way that BioShock allowed you to have weapons in one hand and superpowers in the other, magic, what have you. So too will Judas allow that and kind of rely on that as a central gameplay loop. And there's story and you're kind of in a rapture in space type situation. You're on this derelict space station and you've got this kind of first person narrative. But the, you know, so all of that doesn't sound like Levine is straying too far from what has been successful for him. But there's this big part of it that he's been talking about for 10 years. He had a talk at GDC in 2014 about what he described as narrative Lego. The idea here being that the game will react to player decisions and player whims and whimsy in ways that even the designers themselves aren't particularly in control of, that it will sort of on the fly spin you a yarn and put these pre-written chunks of story together in novel and interesting ways to compensate and account for player agency, so that theoretically everybody who plays it will have a different experience or see things in different order or different ways or whatever. And maybe things that I see, you never see on your playthrough, et cetera, et cetera. So Keighley and the folks at IGN both talked about this. There's a quote from Levine that I will read in its entirety. It's kind of nebulous and but interesting still, I think. He says, quote, "We call it pseudo procedural because it's not like Minecraft where everything's being generated off a set of pure mathematical heuristics. You build all these smaller piece elements in the game, and then you teach the game how to make good levels, essentially, and a good story, and most importantly, reactive to what you do." As a bit of an example, he added, "So when you decide to go, I'm not doing that, I'm going all the way over here, then this game knows what to do. Because in BioShock Infinite, the gamers just went over there, and that game panicked and said, I can't do that, I can't do any of that." So my question to you, Jared, is, does that sound cool? Do you think he's pulling it off? What do you make of this sort of early hands-on for Judas?
I think it sounds cool, but I think he might be describing something that we've kind of been doing at least a little bit for a while. Narrative, like dynamic sort of emergent storytelling has been a thing happening in like indie games for a bit. There was a game like 2 years ago, and I wish I remembered it. It's like a roguelike turn-based.
Oh, are you talking about Wilder Myth?
Yes. Like what he's describing sounds like Wilder Myth. Which isn't to say I wouldn't want to see something like that again, because I think that was really cool.
Yeah.
But what I think where I get a little skeptical is that Ken Levine, the final products that he produces are solid usually. But he's also like pretty good at over-promising or overselling a thing that ends up being a softer version of it in the final product. Infinite, infamously, like he was talking, touting this rail system, right, where you could rail from one side of Columbia to the other. Like the idea that the verticality would be open world just as much as the stuff on the floor. And it turned out it really wasn't open world in either way. The rails were kind of just a way to spin around small arenas, and everything was very localized. Bioshock 2, he kind of promised the big sister would be persistently hunting you the entire game, and like the little things that would end up in these regions that you kind of have to like build up an infamy, and after it gets over a particular line, the region locks down and the little sister, and you have to fight your way out versus the big sister. That was something that he had sort of promised or tried to, the target was that this could happen anywhere at any time. And that's not, that's not the game we got. So I am a fan of swinging wild and aiming high. Him saying the thing does not, I don't expect to see that in the final product. Maybe something, some sort of middle ground or something you have to settle for.
Yeah.
But I am skeptical.
I think that's fair. I mean, he is sort of in that Peter Molyneux school of talking big and hyping up the game and then maybe not particularly delivering. And I think you outlined that very well. Let's say this idea works to an extent that it is interesting enough. Do you think the other parts of the game being so similar to Bioshock is a good thing or a bad thing for you in particular, in your opinion?
For me, I'm not sure. I think the strongest part of the Bioshock games, maybe even especially Infinite, are like the vigors, like just the ability, like Undertow is just like a cool idea. Like that power is just to pull everyone's feet out from under them and like pull them to you.
Yeah.
In ways that are not always predictable, but like you cause so much chaos by using this power, it becomes like its own kind of emergent thing. That is cool. I think, though, that open worldly kind of that same, you know, System Shock sort of tree of evolution, we've kind of been doing a lot of that in the space he's been gone too. Mm-hmm. Like the most recent Prey and especially Moon Crash are like very like maybe the examples of this now, I think. Mm-hmm. Like what he's describing actually maybe sounds a lot like Moon Crash, like a game that is a roguelike run based, but everything is kind of different every time with a persistent kind of going forward, like momentum.
Yeah.
I have no problem playing another one of those. I just don't think, I'm not sure he is describing something that's going to be like the same sort of level of auteur innovation that he may have gotten in 2015. Right. I think he is now, the world is different, and he is not the only person with the only studio making these things at this size anymore.
Such a great point. Yeah, I agree. It actively bums me out that he's sort of as innovative as it sounds like he's trying to be on this one side. It does kind of feel like, man, I wish you were pushing the envelope or trying to reimagine something else, the sort of purely mechanical side. Because, you know, Bioshock, when it was released, felt really fresh and bold. And I do think he's one of those designers that has that the ability to be that way. And clearly there is a lot of ambition in this game on that narrative element. But I wish mechanically it was a little fresher.
I think it's completely okay to not do that, right? Like I kind of assumed maybe I was wrong to assume that maybe FromSoft would have run into a similar problem with Elden Ring, like because Dark Souls and Bloodborne kind of were such strong games that they created a subgenre full of games who have been sort of doing micro iterations to all this, to the point where you can play a lot of Souls likes that are great in their own right. They're not just pretend Dark Souls games anymore. Like they are real strong.
Mm-hmm.
So when they want to make another one, like can they even do it anymore? And turns out in Elden Ring, yes, they can absolutely do it. They had it in them. They've been thinking about this a long time. They really did innovate this thing they did.
Yeah.
It's super possible for Ken Levine's team to do that again. I just, that space, I have a hard time imagining what that looks like.
Well said. Christian, what is your take on what we heard from the new hands-on for Judas?
Yeah, it's an interesting problem that I think is unique to video games of player agency. ultimately you can make this game and then whatever game you make, right? And then someone spends an hour running into a wall and they do that for 2 hours straight, and then the memory overloads and the game glitches and it breaks, and they release the social media post of the game breaking bug, you know, or whatever it is, right? That's kind of a silly example, but you don't know how people are going to interact with your art until it comes out, despite all the playtesting you do. And so much of a game design, it seems like, goes into directing the player and or allowing a broad amount of player freedom to kind of do whatever they want to do and find those moments. And I think my favorite games aren't necessarily what's being described here by these reports from Ken and what Judas is going to be. My favorite games tend to be games that are very authored, but give me the illusion of like I'm choosing that moment. Portal and Portal 2 are great examples of that, where, you know, you solve the puzzle thinking I'm so creative. I broke the game. No one else would have ever thought of this, and that's the only way to solve it. Or Left 4 Dead, you know, the director's just kind of pulling you along to where you're going to go, that you don't realize that the forest you're in is actually just a narrow corridor, and that's the way to pull the players through the levels. Or Metroid Dread is a more recent game where it's a Metroidvania, but so much of that game is forward momentum that you rarely think that you're lost, because it's constantly giving you, it's like, oh, I guess I'll go back here this way. And that's the way to go. Like, literally, that's the way to go. And if you really poke at the seams, you'll see some of that game's shortcomings in terms of Metroidvania design compared to Hollow Knight or something like that, that allows for more freedom or breaking of the systems. But I'm very curious how this idea of letting the player wander somewhere to experience something new, or just to have a thing happen over there, if that's additive to the story. Because, you know, as you were talking about, Jeff, he's been doing a type of narrative for a while now. And if that could truly be additive, where the three of us could be sitting down, you know, whatever year this game comes out, and talking about our narrative experience with the game and have totally different holy crap moments that aren't Far Cry, a bear ran out of nowhere kind of thing, but like a narrative beat moment that happens because we explored the level in a different way. I think that's pretty incredible. I don't know if it's possible, but my gosh, I hope it is.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's, the dream is that it feels like you're, you know, sitting with a dungeon master and they're crafting the story dynamically in real time with you. And, you know, that's the dream, I think, everybody who's been making video games has had, you know, is that like, well, let's make it so that the game can react to the player in the same way a person sitting at a table playing D&D can react to a player. And there's been different approaches to that. But I think the dream is, it's an odd thing though, you know, even as I say that, because the experience of playing the video game should just be the experience of playing the video game, just in the same way that the experience of playing through the campaign of the D&D, you know, session should just be the experience of playing through that story. Only in us getting together later and going, well, you remember when the skeleton jumped out of the closet? It's like, that skeleton never jumped out of the closet. That was
my DM, the skeleton didn't have a key. They were stuck in a closet for hours.
That's the only way that you even are aware of this kind of thing. It's kind of the heavy rain problem, you know, which they remedied later on by being like, hey, we showed you all the branching paths you didn't take in a big old long spreadsheet, you know.
Or the other side of that is the Telltale Walking Dead, where the criticism that folks levied against it later was, well, it didn't matter what I picked because it was all the same anyway. But in the moment, you didn't know that. It was still agonizing to make that decision. Right. Was that experience not good because at the end they all got on the bus or, you know, whatever happened? I don't know.
Jared, do you think it's worthwhile to want to have that sort of communal experience be one of variation, you know, player to player? Like, oh, we can talk about it later and we can all have had different experiences. Is that in itself a worthy goal?
I think like you said, it's kind of a goal that happens anyway, right? Like, if we are all playing this game, when we all talk about the fact that we played this game, we will come to the determination of whether we had the same experience or not.
Yeah.
Trying to sort of dictate that experience, our experience on a call or at a table in the development of the game seems like a cause not worth chasing, right? Like, if you just told a linear story that's very good, we'll talk about that in our own particular experiences with that story individually and how those things differ by ourselves anyway.
Right.
Like you are never, and it's a thing games do a lot that I feel like it's always been a problem, that video games are never really going to mimic the experience of a tabletop game. They can't. Just the mechanisms are different. The experience is different. It's supposed to be this way. Mm-hmm. And it's not like one shouldn't or couldn't or not like one shouldn't try to do the other. It's just can't do the other, right? There is no way, unless we are playing a game, a video game, that is literally me telling you a story that you can mimic the same way, the same interactions you would have at a table, right? I haven't seen it, and maybe it's possible now with the way, you know, technology is going, where you can make a DM that does this. I haven't come there yet, and what he's describing doesn't sound like that either.
Yeah.
It's just why I think a good solid narrative that could have branching paths or whatever is good enough. Trying to revolutionize this thing by kind of just describing the thing as it exists today doesn't make me excited about what's coming out of this thing.
Yeah.
Though I do like, you know, and games also try to do like movie experiences too. But the difference between a movie and a game is you play a game. So like playing the thing is the experience. So just make that better. I just want this game to be like good to play and fun to play. And like he has already proven that he can create a team to create a game that is that. I don't know that his narratives have been so strong that I kind of want to see that Tarantino-ized, like chopped and screwed. Mm-hmm. I think maybe just stick with what we know you're good at. Yeah. I would hate to play this game. I'll hate to play this game and the narrative be so distracting that the thing I know he can do is not as enjoyable as it was.
Yeah. I mean, just to dig down into that a little bit, because I think you make an excellent point, is, you know, the idea of narrative Lego, you know, there's a part of me that's like, hey, there's something cool about, I go to this part of the spaceship, and in a conventional video game, that part is locked off because I'm not supposed to go there yet. Oh, you can't go to wing two because you haven't finished wing one yet. You got to get the key to open the door to open up the next part of the game.
This bookcase is immovable. Yes, right. You literally push a car two city blocks. This bookcase can't be moved.
And I think there's something neat, sort of whiz-bang neat about, no, nothing's closed off. You want to do this one first. You want to do that one second. You know, you want to do reverse order. You want to go to wing two before you finish wing one. You want to go to wing six and see the big crescendo fight there. Well, then that means that when you go back to wing two later, things are different. Like there's something neat about that conceptually, but I do think it's exactly what you're saying, Jarrett, which is what is required to make that work is sort of a narrative that is not as interdependent as a traditional narrative would need to be. Like if I could just reorder everything and it still works, then that's not good storytelling, right? Right?
Exactly my fear. Like the only way to make that work is to make a story that isn't worth telling.
Yeah.
If experiencing it in pieces and whatever pieces you want, and for it to be different all the time, no matter how many times you play it, I just can't imagine that producing something that like really sticks. The technique would be like impressive and the technology impressive, but is the product impressive? I don't know.
I think that's an excellent point. Excellent point. It's going to be interesting to see. Obviously Judas we have no release date for that either, although it sounds like it's getting closer and closer. And I'm very curious about it. I will certainly be playing it. I'm a sucker for any game that has a lockpick mechanic, you know, little lockpick mini game. Levine is great at those. I'm into that. So, Judas. All right. Let's get to the games that we have been playing, because we got some interesting ones there as well, in a segment we call The Playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on The Playlist. Jarrett, I very much enjoyed your written review of Dragon's Dogma 2. I know you put a bunch of hours into that game. And came away with some really interesting thoughts about it. I'd love for you to maybe tell us how you've enjoyed Dragon's Dogma 2, your experience in returning to that franchise, and what you make of the game at this point.
I like can't seem to stop playing this game. it's uncommon and unlike it's probably not the only game, but it's the first game in a while where I've, you know, put days worth of time into the game to write a review, reviews done, published, and then, you know, a week and a half later, I'm still playing this thing. It's, for anyone who's played the first, it is an awful lot like the first. It feels a lot like, I think in my review, I mentioned it feels like Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
Where Sam Raimi got money and made the movie he actually wanted to make. Mm-hmm. This feels like Itsuno got money and made the Dragon's Dogma he actually wanted to make. Which means 80% of the game is like the game he made, but it's bigger and shinier. Maybe not always, doesn't really always run better. Still doesn't have lock on, still has a 2010 camera. Like, a lot of people spend so much time in the past like 12 years trying to say, listen, this game is good, but it's really janky and it's like almost impenetrable in the beginning. But you know what? That's just how it was back in the day. And if you can work yourself through it, you're going to really find a special game here. And it's really sad that I guess say the same thing in 2024.
That's how games were this day that we're still
that's
in.
That's how games were 2 weeks ago, apparently.
Yeah.
But I don't think you're going to find an action RPG open world experience quite like this game. And I think that, to me, is more important. You're going to find... I mean, we're kind of out of the woods where like everybody was doing open world RPGs. We're not really there anymore. But I feel like there's so many examples of like action games that are clearly just kind of walking the chosen path, the well-trodden path, the one that is the most reliable, the safest, or the most predictable. And Dragon's Dogma 2 is not that at all. It pretends it is, and then you end up finding yourself pulled, you know, 3 hours off your plans because things just kind of happen to you out in the wild. It's really one of the, I don't know, I don't think it's going to be like important. I think that's a thing I have to kind of like, as the Dragon's Dogma super stan in me has to kind of come to terms with. I don't think anyone's going to find this game as important as maybe they found Dragon's Dogma or Breath of the Wild or anything like that. But you're going to have, I wish there was just a way for me to like get someone like a 4 hour save where they're just like getting into this stuff and you'll find something you've probably never seen before.
That's such a cool way to talk about it. And it, what's special is that sort of emergent, the stuff that happens at you instead of, you know, you're the stuff that knocks you off your beaten path and forces you to reckon with it rather than what you set out to do that day. That, you know, so many games are, you know, you got a list of quests, go do them. And this game, it sounds like the what's special to you and others is you may have that. You may have that list of things that you intend to do. But the game has other ideas.
It always has other ideas. And even your list of quests is like incomplete because you might find that you completed a quest that seemed pretty standard in the way quests happen. You found a dude, he needs some help. You gave him his help and he walks away. Then you might never see him again in your playthrough, or you just happen to be where he ended up and he has some new things for you. It might not be a real quest and like it's going to jump in your log or whatever. But you have this relationship now. You helped him before. Something's happening down the road. He might need your help again. You can choose to help him or not. And there's not going to be like a quest implication, but like it's going to feel like one for all intents and purposes. There's a lot of that in this game. Some of it is like, you know, escort me to X place and it's kind of a waste of your time. Doesn't really tell you that though. So you're like, again, while you're experiencing it, you don't know that. But when you walk away with a reward that's like underwhelming, you're like, oh, maybe I didn't have to do that. But the game masks that so well behind all of its interactions, even the way you complete quest objectives. Like, it doesn't really tell you something's complete until the quest is over. Every step is like, you know, X, you gave X this, or you told X this, or you met X here. Very like nondescript, very neutral sounding, like flag post in your objectives to not reveal what kind of effect it might have on the rest of your quest. Now, it's not gonna, the way you solved this one particular step, the way they tell you you solved it, isn't gonna immediately throw you an idea that maybe everyone around you hated that. You don't know that.
Right.
And I think it does a great job of obfuscating those kind of things. Also, like, the game is just early on very difficult. Things that are safe, that would be safe in other games, are not safe here. Getting in a fast travel ox cart to get from one place to another, you'll get interrupted all the time. And the things that are interrupt you might start off as just like wolves messing with the guards around it. But once you get out to deal with the wolves, at any given point, something bigger and scarier might see you and decide that it's time to fight me as well. I think in the video review, I had a clip of me getting out of the ox cart to fight some goblins or whatever. And that turned into a fight with an ogre who saw me fighting goblins. The ogre's jumping around, breaking the, like trying to, attacking the cart. And I'm trying to wheel it away from the cart. And as soon as I think I have that in hand, a griffin literally dive bombs both of us, hits the cart, blows it up. So I can't get back in the cart. My 100 gold's out of just up in dust and up in smoke. But now I have to fight an ogre and a griffin at the same time. And I just thought I was getting in a cart to go peacefully to some other part of this country. And this was like level 4. Like, I was not prepared for this. And that's the game you're playing.
Wow. Talk a little bit about the combat itself, because I think it also manifests that level of kind of emergent, unpredictable, and kind of wacky eventualities, right?
Yeah. On the surface, it is so the Monster Hunter team overlaps with the Dragon Dogma team.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the combat design is inspired by Monster Hunter. Which is, if you ever played Monster Hunter, it's an action game, like weapon-based classes, big physics and emergent sort of environment becomes really important when you're fighting what is essentially like a boss rush game in 3D. Attacking specific parts of an enemy is just as important as doing damage to a life bar. All that translates to Dragon's Dogma, where if you have a chimera, all three of its heads do different things. But if you start damaging and cutting off heads, it no longer does those things.
Yeah.
A griffin can fly unless you beat up its wings, and it can't. Or if when you attempt to do so, it starts to get furious at you and it will change its style to make sure you can't do it again. That kind of stuff from the monster's perspective. Your characters can take what are called vocations in this game, essentially jobs. All very action heavy, but the jobs themselves are from your standard, you know, sword and board fighter, your archer, your thief with two daggers, two more advanced stuff like warriors who just do two-handed things, mages and sorcerers, mages being more healing and buffy kind of stuff, and sorcerers who cast big spells. To your more advanced stuff, like a trickster who does no damage but kind of uses fumes and incense to confuse all of the monsters around you and get them to hit each other. The Mystic Spearhand, which is like a dragoon, basically. Lots of interesting takes on how all those things work, just like mechanically, like the way magic works in this game is like none other game with magic. Magic, you have to stop and charge for a period of time. While you're charging, you can kind of choose your targets, but it's like, especially sorcerers, you might be waiting 5 or 6 seconds to charge a big spell, and you are vulnerable and in danger during those 5 or 6 seconds. So it's really about like navigating the right time to do it. Thieves and archers are pretty good at climbing up monsters, but they're, you know, they don't wear heavy armor, so they fly when you throw them, when creatures throw you. But physics, again, very, very important in this game. Like everything that can be picked up can be thrown, and depending on its own weight can do different amounts of damage to people, including your party members. You can pick them up and throw them at people too. The way you climb, like climbing up monsters becomes kind of a strategy that if you are heavier, you become more of a burden on the monster. So like the trade-off of being heavy is that you move slower, but if you were to climb on a monster's head, it takes way less to knock it over because you're so heavy. If you take a running start to jump and climb on a monster, you hit them in the chest, you become like a cannonball almost. You can knock them over that way. Longer, taller characters you made make climb on monsters easier. Things that the game's not going to tell you, kind of like all that kind of stuff. There's also like weird stuff and more subtle things the game's going to tell you. Like certain monsters are more attracted to certain genders. Ogres will almost always abduct women first. Like they'll just hop into a fight, grab the nearest woman, and then hop away.
Oh, man.
Bandits always attempt to rob men first. Just like weird, very weird little things that you learn, like just as you're going. Nobody tells you anything. It's just kind of like you watch it happen and you realize it keeps happening. Right. Yeah. And I feel like that is maybe the biggest thing I found with colleagues of mine who had never played it before. Just like watching them learn these things, like as they happen.
Yeah.
It's been a really interesting experience. And you know, not everybody loves it, but I feel like most of the people at least respect it.
Well, I love hearing you talk about it. I love reading write about it, and it's awesome to have you here during this game's early period, because it's just so fun hearing you describe it. My last question, I guess, is obviously you wrote a review, you spent a lot of time with it. You started out this whole conversation saying you're still playing it. What is it that is bringing you back, even post what you would normally consider the end of your experience with a game?
I missed a whole lot during my first playthrough. Kind of, I don't say purposefully, but I'm big on not like 100% completing games. I feel like games are far too big these days. Yeah. And the option to 100% complete things is kind of like bait. And I'm not going to, I decided sometime years ago, I'm not going to take the bait anymore. I'm just going to play my game. And I did not want to do a completionist run of the review playthrough. I just wanted to like really experience what I was going to experience and not try to do too much, because I feel like that's the best way to play these things. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, and this might not be right anymore, but I feel like that's how people play the game, right? I don't think most people really want to 100% complete these things. But then I realized how much I was missing. So like I could have a second playthrough and have like a significantly different experience. And I wanted to know, like there are pretty big events that just never happened to me. If you play this game straight through, even if you do a bunch of side quests and stuff, there's a whole region, like a whole country in this game you don't go to because it never tells you to. There is no main story quest that brings you there. And there's no obvious side quest that gets you there. You have to explore to find it, because the people in there are isolated and don't want you to find it. The game doesn't want you to find it. Wow. And when you do find it, it's very hostile to you, both narratively and, you know, just gameplay wise. And I missed that completely in my first playthrough. And now that I'm like in it, it's really interesting to see. But there's also like lots of interactions between things I did experience that interact in ways I didn't know. Like the Medusa it's you see the Medusa and, you know, a lot of the promo material, so you know it exists. And Medusa's head you can take and, like Perseus, you know, petrify people with it.
Yeah.
But you can, so long as you're timing it right, you can take Medusa's head and petrify a lot of things that you didn't think you could. And finding ways to interact, to use that and interact with other quests I'm doing or other NPCs or whatever has been a very interesting experience, because it definitely changes the way some of those quests resolve or gives me options I didn't think I had that I definitely do. And that is fascinating to me.
Awesome. Wow. So cool. That's Dragon's Dogma 2. Jared Green's experience with it on a number of levels. I just love hearing you talk about it, man. It's been really cool.
If you don't want to pay $70 for it, I get it. When it's on sale, try it.
Yeah. Yeah. Dragon's Dogma 2. Before we move on, we'll take another quick break for a sponsor. All right, Christian Spicer, I'm really excited to get into your playlist because there's a game that I played during a Steam Next Fest that I was like, you got to play this. You got to play this. I feel like it is Christian Spicer catnip. And now you have played it, and I'm very nervous because you and I have both played the full version of a game called Pepper Grinder, a new Devolver.
You like it a pepper?
You like it a pepper? I say a pepper for you.
I say win. Hey, bring it up a pepper. Pepper Grinder, I played it on almost exclusively on my Steam Deck. I played a little bit on my desktop PC, but I played the rest of it almost exclusively on my
Steam Deck. I'm surprised to hear that because I had major problems with my Steam Deck on this game. Did you not have any issues?
I had two game crashing bugs. One happened on desktop and one on Steam Deck, but otherwise I was a stable 60 on my Steam Deck experience. I didn't have to fiddle with anything.
The game completely crash and lose all the progress I'd made. And I also had a weird thing where I couldn't get it to play audio on my Steam Deck. Plays audio fine on my desktop, but no music, no sound effects. Very, very strange.
You're in public. We're not. There's no audio. It's handheld. I'm at home. No, we got you. No,
all of
audio.
The like Steam Deck sound effects were working. All of the like push funny. A button, it goes doo doo doo. You know, I'm like the sound is there. Anyway,
yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I had no issues. I mean, like I said, I had two. I had to force quit out of the game and relaunch the game bugs, one on desktop and one on Steam Deck. But otherwise it was flawless. It took me about, the Steam Deck said my, or Steam, I guess, said my playtime was 3.5 hours.
Short game. Short games are good. We were just talking about that.
Big fan of short games. It was like $17, I think, when I bought it, like this first week of release, something like that. I really like Pepper Grinder. You were not the only person that was like, Christian, you got to play this game. Other people were texting and posting on Discord.
Like, I was the most important.
You were not the only person I ignore that said like you should play Pepper Grinder. I really like it. I don't love it. I feel bad. I feel like the hip uncle who everybody's like, hey, here comes the hip uncle. He's gonna love it. And I'm like, it's not that great.
Too hip.
I really, really like it. I don't think it is at the level of Celeste, which is an unfair comparison because I think Celeste is one of the best games. And I also wouldn't put Pepper Grinder at the level of Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, which is a slightly different game in that it does the Metroidvania style exploration that Pepper Grinder and Celeste do not. But Prince of Persia also does some incredible, absolutely incredible top tier side scrolling platforming. And I think the ways I think Pepper Grinder ultimately doesn't hit the highest of highs. One, its story is nothing. Like you're a pirate, go get some treasure. But like also there's these monsters. It's just absolutely meaningless, which is fine. I think a mechanics based game can still be incredible even without a great story. Viewfinder, yeah, which is a 3D puzzle-y kind of platform game that I loved. I didn't particularly get into its story in a really meaningful
Nobody
way.
Nobody talks about the story of Sonic the Hedgehog. You know what I'm saying?
Right. I mean, well,
other than the fact that there are multiple hit movies based
all on it. All of the youth that carry it forward only talk about the story of Sonic the Hedgehog. But yes. But I don't think its story is particularly great. And you have this drill and you're able to drill in certain sections of levels. Some are like underground, some is through ice, some is through buildings. You know, there's different parts of the world that your drill allows you to cut in. And the way you manipulate yourself in space is with the analog stick, because you have full 360 degree control of where you are drilling in this space. But you're also drilling with a certain amount of momentum that then you can boost and jump out of the drillable space out into the environment to kind of link chains or combos and do some platforming. And I found that I didn't think that that 360 movement in the drillable space allowed for the level of precision that I wanted, where I felt like I was kind of fighting against the game mechanics to pull off the cool moves versus doing the thing as intended. And I'm curious if you felt that way also, Jeff, or is just my skills aren't there.
I think that's the fine line that the game is walking, is that you're able to walk around and do and jump and do, you know, be a person. You're just not very powerful, right? Your jump is low. You're slow, but you strap yourself to this giant drill thing, and now you're kind of like holding on for dear life, right? And I think the experience that it's trying to convey, and that I really liked, was, yeah, you don't have precise control over this thing because it's got a bit of a life of its own. It's got this, you're just kind of holding on to this very powerful projectile, for lack of a better word. And it's pulling you through the material that you're drilling through, and you're able to aim it. And I think that I found that really fun. Like, I was glad, or not glad, I enjoyed a bit of, oh my gosh, I didn't get that little gem or collectible because I zoomed past it because, oh my gosh, I'm just sort of Sonic the Hedgehogging my way through this, right? Those old Sonic games, 2D Sonic games, there's a bit of like, you're on the roller coaster, hold on. You're not going to get every ring because your speed and momentum is such that the experience of the speed is superior to the perfect collection. And I enjoyed that about Pepper Grinder as well. Though I acknowledge what you're saying is not wrong. It's just, it didn't rub me as wrong as it sounds like it rubbed you.
Yeah, I liked it for those moments where I'd like zoom past and see a gold coin, which is kind of like this game's version of the strawberries in Celeste. And I did not go back and collect very many of the gold coins. I kind of got what I got and moved on with it. But where I found the movement mechanic frustrated me was in the more demanding sections of the game. Yeah. That, you know, I'm navigating through a minefield and you can have this little grapple chain that locks onto a thing and swings you, and then you're navigating again. And I won't spoil the final boss, but the second form of the final boss, I feel like, which I thought was really cool conceptually, but I feel like it asked a certain amount of precision from you that I was fighting against instead of with. And what I like, yeah, and when I think Sonic Mania does it well, and I think Celeste, again, I'm sorry, I'm going to keep saying it, does really well, or even Prince of Persia: The Lost Crown, is you get into these moments of almost a flow state and your fingers are doing the thing, or even Rock Band, right? Like, you're playing a song a little above your skill level on Rock Band, but all of a sudden your fingers just start doing the thing and they're two steps ahead of where your brain is, and you're constantly thinking you're going to run into the wall, but you don't. Like, chasing that feeling is euphoric. And I felt like, again, not a lot of time because the game isn't that long, but I feel like within Pepper Grinder, I stumble out of that flow state. I'd have moments where I'm in it and I'm like, you're in a grindable area or a drillable area and it's awesome. Then you jump out and you blast out. Then you're skirting across the top of water and then you dive back into the water. Then you come out and then, oh, bonk, I shot backwards. I didn't mean to. Okay, reload. Now I shot down. Okay, I didn't mean to shoot. And it's like just enough of those kind of like being in the car with someone as they learn to drive a stick shift.
Yeah.
It takes the fun out of it pretty quick and your neck gets sore. That I feel like didn't quite capture that thrill of speed. And I think the last kind of two notes that I'll make, and one I think highlights this more, is also the boss battles, which the last one I died on a lot, but I struggled with some of the
boss
battles.
They're frustrating. They're difficult. Straight up frustrating. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, I agree.
They're difficult. And then you'd come into those and you'd have to reload the intro animation a little bit. That was like the rest of the game has that pretty good seamless. You're back. You die. It doesn't matter. You're seamless. You're back. It, you know, really cool. You're right back where you left off more or less. And you get to do the challenge. The boss battles, you'd have to come back in. The boss would come out and animate. Or there's one where there's like a pre-level to the boss you have to do again to get to the boss. I found that to be frustrating. And I generally think this game would have been better without the boss battles. Like they're all, except for the second stage of the final one, they're all the same.
You know, totally agree with that. I did not find the boss battles particularly fun. I agree.
They weren't additive. And I think, and that goes into my last kind of critique of the game, where again, a very good game. But the reason why I don't think it's kind of the top tier of this type is that I prefer these types of games that are constantly building and iterating on a thing that by the end, you are just this composer, this maestro of like conducting, not destruction necessarily, but navigational god. As you're dashing, skidding,
you start juggling, and by the end you've got chainsaws and you're juggling 16 things. And
this game introduces some new things along the way, but it never really puts them together in this way that where you're like, holy crap, I am at the Hollywood Bowl conducting the symphony. How did I find myself here? And I'm doing all of this and it plays out. And instead it's like, no, you have this for a level. Now you have this for a level. And now you're doing a shooter for a level. And I feel like it doesn't quite come together. And before people ask, yes, I did pay money in game currency to change my character's hair to have red hair. So that wasn't the issue I had with the game.
So you did get a few of those gold coins.
I did get a few of those gold coins.
I think that's fair. I feel like I had a more positive time with this game, and I really loved the charm and sort of ingenuity of the central mechanic. I don't think it compares to an Ori. It doesn't compare to the Prince of Persia. It doesn't compare to these more, I think, robust, sophisticated, deeper experiences that you're talking about. But I also kind of think it's not really trying to do that. I think it's a throwback to a little bit of it's Sonic the Hedgehog, you know, it's I don't know. And maybe it still fails for you on that level, but for me, it was well worth the time and energy I put into playing it. And I just thought it was clever. I was like Dig Dug meets, you know, whatever, Sonic the Hedgehog. It was great.
Yeah. Well, I cannot wait for a sequel, right? I'd love to see this iterated on. I think it's cool. It's beautiful. And they clearly have a grasp on making a game that digging mechanic. There's parts where you're altering terrain to, I'll be vague, to bring things to you. And I was like, oh, more of this. Like that moment was really, really fun.
That's Pepper Grinder. That's on Christian's playlist. What else have you been playing?
I'm nothing if not a man of my word. I'm nothing. I finally started Diablo 4. It is on Game Pass. Bobby is gone. And I was like, I can play this. This game they announced in the middle of the podcast announcing games are going to come to other platforms. The Microsoft podcast. I am playing on my Xbox Series X is where I chose to engage with this on Game Pass. I am playing as a druid. I am very early. I'm probably a Pepper Grinder's length into Diablo 4. Only a few hours. Coming into it at this stage, I agree with a lot of what you said back when we first talked about it on this show, Jeff. Like, it's very pretty. I kind of wish the camera was zoomed out a little bit. I'm used to my Diablos being a little zoomed out more than where this one is. But my goodness, this is a very pretty game. The only other thing that I kind of add, I think at this stage as a new player that I find curious is, man, I feel like I don't feel welcomed into the game. Like it feels like I'm learning French. I'm having the nightmare where I'm in French class during the exam and I didn't register for French. And it's like, welcome to Season of the Warriors. And I'm like, what? I haven't done anything yet. And it's like, do you want to play this version or do you want to do this? You get this by joining up with your friends. And it's, you know, all of these live service games, I think, have that issue of bringing people in and trying to show them all the cool stuff that's become added to the game since it came out.
Yeah. Feels like you're playing double dutch a bit. You're like, I'm going to get in here. All right, here I go. I'm going to jump in.
I just want to play. I think I might not be a druid, though, unless druids become cool later. I kind of miss my necromancer from Diablo 3, but the opening cinematic is awesome. I mean, holy moly, that's very pretty. And as you talked about and guests talked about it on the show when this game first came out, very few games make you always feel cool the way Diablo always makes you feel cool. And it's like, you played for 20 minutes, turn into a bear. I will, Diablo. I will turn into a bear. Thank you. Like, that's pretty fun. What about if you did a werewolf? I thought you'd never ask. Yeah. Okay. What about an axe that's chained with lightning? Well, why would I do that? I can turn into a wolf and a... Oh, and an axe that chains with lightning. This is great. So I'm having a lot of fun. I'm curious to see how sticky it is for me post-game. Have you done any of the seasons or anything like that with it? Did you stick with it?
I did the first season pretty intensely, but I haven't done... They just announced this massive patch that's like, we're changing how loot works completely. And it's like, I haven't even dug into what those changes are, but people are saying it's... like a completely different game. So I'm curious about all that.
Didn't that also happen in Diablo 3?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. They did in Diablo 3.
The gold store or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And it made Diablo 3 way better, in my opinion. So maybe, you know, maybe that'll happen here as well. And I haven't heard the buzz yet about how this patch is literally like, I don't even think it's in yet. Maybe it is.
Okay. Maybe that. I was surprised that, like, I expected to see more Diablo 4 in my zeitgeist, in my social spheres as coming to Game Pass. I thought it'd be get a pretty big shot in the arm, but I didn't see a bunch of people talking about it this week. Maybe that's just not in my circles for whatever reason, but it runs well on Xbox. I'm playing in the 60 frames per second mode. It gives you the option of 60 or 30 with a little bit of graphics and some ray tracing. And I was like, I want the 60 FPS, but it's a very pretty game. It works well on console. They've learned their lessons. People are like, we know we've been playing it for a year and a half.
It sure beats clicking to your fingers bleed. I'll tell you that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
It's Diablo 4 on Christian's playlist. We already talked about Pepper Grinder. I want to talk just briefly about a few games. One is called Stolen Realm, which I was keen to try. This is an indie game that is basically like, what if Divinity Original Sin, but without all that pesky story? It's like a Larian combat system, not quite Baldur's Gate 3, but a little bit reminiscent of it, but much more akin to something like a Divinity Original Sin. But it's just streamlined, just the fights. It's like Divinity Original Sin, oops, all fights. And in that sense, it's kind of fun. It's meant to be done in co-op, or at least it offers that. And I think it's hangs its hat on co-op. I only played it single player. But I like it. It has become more of a roguelite. It has become more of a, just fight after fight after fight, and where you're going to go and what loot are you going to get and how you're going to upgrade your team and how you're going to constitute your team and what, you know, it's a party of adventurers of different classes, and you're going to outfit them in various ways, and they're all going to have different special abilities, and you've got action points to spend, and that allows you to, you know, move and attack in different ways. And you've got a whole team, and you've got bad guys that are on all sides of you, and you got to figure out how to survive. And it's that, and then it's that again, and then it's that again, and then it keeps being that. And there's nothing wrong with it, because that combat system is pretty darn fun and pretty addictive. Turn-based, obviously, and I love turn-based combats. I think the graphics are pretty simplistic. It's very polygonal. I think it's an aesthetic choice, but it's not as pretty as a Larian game. But
I think that's the one that's like voxely, almost like a Roblox like shapes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I think I remember this game now.
Yeah, it's. I think it's an aesthetic decision. They're like, it looks kind of paper crafty almost, and. When you're zoomed out, you know, you play top down isometric, you know, in the same way that you would a Divinity game. So when you're zoomed out, like it gives the appearance of detail, but if you ever zoom in, or if you're outfitting your character and it shows you your character, you know, big image of your character, it doesn't look great, but that's fine. It's colorful. It's fine. I think the voice acting is nice. And this game is, I think it's solid. If you like that combat and you just want pure concentrated combat without having to click through a bunch of dialogue choices, you know, in those games, or deal with all the, you know, all the inventory management and other stuff that goes along with a big, heavy RPG. You just like want to get in and get those cool turn-based battles. Stolen Realm might be for you. I think it's pretty solid. And I think it would be a cool game to try co-op, because it's, you know, in the same way those Larian games allow you to play co-op and just pick one part of a team and you got to figure out how you synergize and stuff. I think that would be a fun way to play Stolen Realm as well.
Any game with good, that is good mechanically, should have a, I just want to play this game mode. Like,
yeah.
So, the concept of, yeah, we played Divinity. We think Larian is really good at turn-based RPGs. So what we're going to do is just that without the story. You just want to make the wet puddle electrify.
Yeah, exactly. You.
That's perfect. I think that's a great idea.
It does all that stuff. It does all the environmental. In fact, the maps will be like, for no reason at all, it'll just be like, there's a thing you can blow up here. You know, it's like, it doesn't even attempt to sort of justify it in any narrative sense. It's just like, hey, there's a node over here of explodey electricity. And you're like, okay, I'm going to explode that electricity because that'll be fun.
I think that's a great point. I loved the Rocksteady Batman games for that moment where it was for that reason. You could even just load in from menu. It was like, you like this combat? Go. Just go.
Yeah.
You walk into a room and it's like, here's some dudes. Do the thing you like doing. I will, Rocksteady. I will. Thank you.
I think Final Fantasy 16 is getting, I think the next DLC is going to have like a Bloody Palace thing, like from Devil May Cry, which was just like, do you mm-hmm. want to play this as long as possible without having to worry about navigating platform or anything like that? And the answer is usually yes.
Yeah.
Final Fantasy 16 with that option, especially since the game that like really you don't really lock in the combat system until like the last third of that game. So yeah. It gets really good then, and then it's over. So having an opportunity to just kind of do it forever is like exactly what I was.
Yeah.
Thinking. The God of War's roguelite add-on thing that they did. What was that called?
What's it called?
Valheim?
Valheim.
Something like that, right?
Valhalla.
Yeah, Valheim's a different game.
It's just a roguelike with some story, but like it's really just
do the cool fight system. It's a cool fight system. Just do it.
Perfect. Thank you.
Last of Us Part 2. I think the Part 2 PS5 version of that also did that, where it's like, hey, this game actually has really great combat, but most of you didn't notice because you were wrapped in the story. Go do it. Go do the killing.
We're designing this so that you can play this game now because we made a really good game to play. I think that's perfect. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. A couple of other things I want to bring up really briefly, just because it was Steam did a whole week of Deck Builders Fest. It's like they've been reading my emails. I love Deck Builders and I love fests. So this felt very perfect for me. So I couldn't not mention it. I went deep. I love that Steam is like, we're going to pluck out a really deep subgenre that not a lot of people are super into, but there's enough of you out there that we're going to make a whole week where we're just going to do these wild discounts and demos and stuff. Anyway, I played a bunch of them and I'm going to talk about two that came out of my experience here because they're so different. I mean, a lot of deck builders, I'll be honest, and I talk about this a lot on the show. As much as I'm willing to play pretty much any like roguelite deck builder, I'll give any of them a shot. A lot of them do a lot of very similar things and they can fall into ruts. And sometimes that's okay because they're so good, you know, that it's still fun to play them. But I do like it when there's some innovation. And there's a couple of games that I tried demos for. One just came out and one is not out yet. But they both had demos for the Deck Builders Fest. I want to bring them up. One is called Rogue Voltage. Rogue Voltage. This game is not out yet, but it is very much on my radar based on the demo. I will try to explain this briefly. Basically, it is a roguelite game where all of your actions are based on wiring circuits together. So it's not exactly a deck builder in the sense that you're getting cards. What you are actually acquiring when you win a fight and you get loot is a node or a component of your circuit board. And you have a certain number of spaces in your backpack. Your character is some sort of, you know, cyberpunk whatever, future man who relies on this technology. And you can assign spaces in your pack to have these different nodes, and some of them generate power and others of them use that power to do things. So if you want to shoot your blaster, for example, to do damage, you need to power it. And your turn is flipping the switch of your backpack and having it do all the things. So if I want to shoot my blaster, I need to pull a wire from the power generating node to the blaster node. And when I flip the switch, it'll generate power. It'll shoot it through that wire and it'll power the blaster, and the blaster will go off and do 1 point of damage or whatever a blaster does. Very straightforward. Where it gets more complicated is that you can create these wild synergies where you're storing power one turn, amplifying it, sending it through, using it in multiple ways, splitting off wires to do different things. And it starts kind of simplistic, but you get, you know, you loot things and you get more of these nodes, and some nodes do wild, goofy things where they split off into two different wires. Some wires are one color, another wires are another color. You can't plug one wire's color into another wire's thing. Some nodes only accept wires of a specific color. So you're like doing this basically logic puzzle to do the combat. And I found it brilliant. I wish the aesthetic was a little bit more to my liking. It's pixel art, which I like generally, but I just found the world to be kind of grimy and not super fun to be in, but the pure mechanics made up for it. Very clever, very innovative. And there were some really wild things. The other thing that it does that I absolutely love, this goes back to a game that I still cherish from my youth called Grandia 2. In Grandia 2, there was a timeline. And a lot of games, turn-based games, will do this. You'll see the timeline of when your characters are going to act and when bad guy characters are going to act. And you can manipulate that timeline in certain ways, knock them back so that if a bad guy's about to do a move and he's going to attack you, you can knock him back and you can move before him and hopefully kill him before he ever even has a chance to act. Well, this game does that as well. And they do it through this sci-fi sort of chrono idea. But it's super cool. And so you can charge things in your backpack that let you manipulate, push enemies back and pull you forward in the timeline. And you can also, it's really wild how you also have to think about storing excess amounts of energy. You can generate energy on your turn and then store it and transform it into plasma. And the plasma can be used to buy things at the end of a fight. So it's not just like, oh, you're going to loot things. You do loot things, but you can augment your loot by thinking ahead and going, hey, not only am I going to get my, you know, decisive victorious blow here on the bad guy, I'm going to win the fight. But if I do it with enough excess energy that I can transform into plasma, I will actually get bonus loot. So layers and layers of this wild logic puzzle and just a really clever concept. It's called Rogue Voltage. The other one, much simpler, much, much simpler, a game called Mori Karta. This is a game that just came out. And the idea about this game is you've got cards that come up. You have a deck. That is the only deck in play. The bad guys you're fighting invade your deck. They put their cards in your deck. Their cards are going to come up. So are your cards. You don't know what order. You can look at any time what's in the deck, their cards, your cards. You can see what's in the deck. You just don't know what order the cards are coming up. But when the cards come up, they are split in half vertically. So the left-hand side does something and the right-hand side does something. And they have costs on either of those sides. And you decide whether you're going to pull the card to the left or push the card to the right. And in doing so, trigger that half of the card. You have to do something with the card. You can't not play it. You pull that card and you either do the left side or the right side. And the entire game is left or right. It's literally the, you know, Tinder of deck building games. It's are you swiping left? Are you swiping right? But there's a lot of really interesting complexity that's built in because you're building up energy, and then sometimes the cost of swiping left will be zero, but the cost of swiping right will be, you know, three energy. And you didn't know that card was going to come up. And sometimes the thing that happens by swiping to the left with zero energy is bad for you. And sometimes you have to have that energy to have the good thing happen to you, or the, you know, the bad thing happen to the bad guy. And so maybe you didn't generate enough energy before you got to that point. So you're forced to do the bad thing. You're like, if I had had more energy, I could have done the good thing. So you're constantly.
Which is what I use all the time around my house. I'm like, if I had the energy, more energy, I would have done the good thing. I'm sorry. I had to do the bad thing. It's not the ice cream. I didn't have the energy for the vegetables. I'm sorry.
It's me and my deadlines. I would have sent this to you, but I just didn't. Yeah. It's mad energy, man.
I didn't have it. Left.
That's probably anyway, I don't know if I'm doing a good job explaining this game, but I thought that it was a very clever concept. It wants to tell you a cool story. I didn't find the story completely cool. Personally, I was kind of uninterested in the story, but it aspires to be a really strong narrative experience. I thought the art is gorgeous in Mori Karta, beautiful, beautiful art, and a really novel idea. Very simple, very simple. Literally all you're doing is either left or right the whole time. And still there's a lot of really cool strategy and, innovation there. So two really strong games, I thought, from the Steam Deck Builders Fest. And I love that Deck Builders were getting a little spotlight. So I wanted to give a little spotlight here on the show as well.
The Deck Builders Sale Fest was my first sort of demonstration that there's like a lot more of those than I thought there were.
Dude, scary how many there are. It's like, how do any of these make any money at all? I don't know. But man, good on people for making them. We'll talk a little bit about board games real quick. Right now. All right, the reason I wanted to do a quick tabletop time with Jarrett here is that he has played a game that was just on Kickstarter, and I'm very curious how you got hands on it, and it looks like a really interesting game. Tell us about it.
I don't think I realized it was a game I had seen like 1,000 times because of all the social media ads from it being on Kickstarter until I saw it in person at PAX East this past weekend.
Oh, right on. Yeah.
I got an appointment for it, so I went through it with a friend of mine, Scott White, who did a bunch of board game content for IGN as well. Also a Rational Passions alum. We sat down and played Gundak together. Gundak is a deck builder. It certainly has a deck building element. You play on a mat that is, I forget how many squares.
3x3, I think.
I think it's 3x3, unless you play four players, in which it like 6x6, maybe. There are four factions that you start with. One's like undead. One is the orcish sort of creatures. There's like a knights with griffins. And then there's an elven thing. They all do different things. They all like, you know, both graphical and mechanical personalities. Some of which you kind of expect, like the undead can bring themselves back to life. Orcs can kind of like levy lots of power with the risk of being exposed afterwards, things like that. But super simple concept. You have a fortress, basically, that is also your deck. And every turn you draw from the deck and have to play something from your hand onto the actual battlefield itself. The battlefield is these 9x9 squares, but are filled by these matching square cards that are all units. The units have different powers, both like different ranks. So they're like 1, 2, or 3, and 3 being the strongest, 1 being the weakest. When they usually, when they play, they do something or have some sort of special ability. Usually not crazy. Like they almost all have like an advantage over some other type of monster, but the more expensive or more advanced monsters can do something else that's kind of cool. And the whole idea is you play them onto your field and then kind of slowly move them across the field with the goal of getting to your opponent's fortress and taking it over. Take it over, you have to, if you're standing in front of it, an enemy is standing in front of your fortress, you draw from your deck, you can kind of mill it away. And once there are no cards, your deck is empty and it's just the fortress. If I'm standing in front of your fortress, by the end of the turn, I win. So a lot of trading, a lot of like maneuvering. There's like a real sort of positional strategy kind of element, as well as the sort of luck of the draw kind of element, combining to create a very unique game. All these factions start with 10 specific faction cards, but after that, there's like a pool of general cards that you can just kind of make put into your deck. So every game can have a little bit of element of difference between games, because not every deck has to be exactly the same. They come with sample compositions and like the in the booklet, but once you start getting comfortable with deck building, you can kind of make it your own. Which was a thing we didn't really do when we played there, but I did buy it afterwards, so I kind of plan to get into that a little bit more. But it was a very interesting experience. Haven't played a game quite like that. I think there was a game, a trading card game years ago called, I think it was Seven Seas, that I think I play a little bit of, and that's what it reminds me of the most. But yeah, it was really cool. Really glad I saw it.
That's awesome. So you liked it enough to purchase it?
Yeah, and I think it's something that I feel like what I remember seeing about it before I got to sit down and play it always sounded like something I kind of wanted anyway. So when I played it and realized it was looking and feeling like the thing I thought it was, I was like, yeah, I gotta know more. So I bought it.
Right on. That's called Gudnak, G-U-D-N-A-K. And I think that if you look on Kickstarter, the Kickstarter has ended, but they're offering up pre-orders so people can still purchase the game. It did very well on Kickstarter, over $100,000 raised of a $10,000 goal. So, and they talk about it being really easy to teach and kind of, you know, not super complex, but.
I think it's I probably made it sound more complicated than it is. As soon as you play, the demo we did like a one round of us just kind of learning on the fly, and then we just the game after we were off the races.
That's great. Gotta love games like that you can pick up and give to people really quickly, onboard people really quickly. Very cool. Thanks for telling me about that, because I've been curious about it, having seen it on Kickstarter myself. I hadn't heard anybody that actually got hands on with it, so. I'm very curious to hear about Gudnak. All right. Well, that's going to be it for this episode of DLC. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But Jared Green, thank you so much for being here. I understand now why so many people suggested we have you on. It's been an absolute delight chatting with you.
Happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. Tell folks where they can keep up with you and all the cool stuff that you do online.
These days, you can follow the various wrestling or video game related tweets. Do we still call them tweets? X's? I don't know.
Whatever.
You know what that website is. I am there at Jarrett John. That is where, if I am being smart, I am posting my writing, usually at these days from IGN. Also, I have started this year a zine where I am designer and publisher, an editor in chief of, that I have contracted and wrangled some of my friends to be involved in. We published the first issue in February, and the second issue should come out in April. Details on my Twitter.
Very cool.
Keep your eyes out for that.
Love it. Excellent. Christian Spicer, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
Oh, it's spring break for the kids, man. That's what I got going on this week. Spring break.
I got through mine already, man. I'm on the other side. It's beautiful over here. You're going to love it when you get through it.
No, so far we're having fun. They successfully robbed the liquor store. They got the money home. We got to get out of here, though. The house is hot. They go hard for spring break, my kids.
Sounds like it. My goodness.
I don't know how they do it, but they go hard. Social media, Threads and Instagram, Christian_Spicer. If I'm active on social, those are probably the places. If you really want to see what's going on or chat with me directly, our Discord for this very show. It's a great community, man. People are, Jeff, I don't know if you've seen it. People are trying to get a cereal bracket going. I mean, there's one going, but they're trying to like goad us into it.
It happened.
But they're like trying to bait us, and Lana's talking about Canadian cereals. It's a whole, that's a place to be. I talk video games and Canadian cereals.
I literally have had a single cereal in the last decade. I've just stopped trying other cereal. I found the one I liked. So I'm going to be basically useless, but I still am up for doing it.
You eat Quarry because it's crunchy. I get it. That's I understand. Right. And then this show, it's also on Threads and Instagram as DLC Hype Train, and then on YouTube where you can find some video segments that we put up, which is at DLC Pod.
Indeed. You can follow me on socials at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. Other shows I do include the Filmcast, talking about movies and TV shows. We Have Concerns, which is a comedy science show. Do the Book Club over there on the YouTube page, which is youtube.com/CannataJeff. And the Fan Controlled Show on the Fan Controlled Sports and Entertainment website. And anywhere you get podcasts, really. You can find all that stuff. Let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts.
Hey, give us a suggestion.
Jared, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
I have to imagine people have seen this already. But for some reason, you need an extra set of motivational words to get you there. X-Men 97 is exactly what you're looking for.
Yes.
I don't watch much television, but I am a gigantic X-Men fan, and it is a direct sequel to the 1997 cartoon, and it absolutely knows it is, you know, 20 years removed, and it's doing its best to sort of fill that space, and it's doing it very well, in my opinion. Not perfect, I think, but I think anyone who likes the X-Men can appreciate this.
Mm-hmm. Well, usually I wait till the end to do our listener suggested parting gift, which is always sent in to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. But there's some synergy here, and I wanted to read this one. I think you might get a kick out of it too, Jarrett. This comes to us from John Terranova, who writes in at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. He says, my parting gift is X-Men 97. I was one of the first people to work on this series, so I'm completely biased. But knowing what's ahead for the series, I think any X-Men comic book fan will love this show. Jeff, I know on the Filmcast you mentioned never watching the original series. We made this so that anyone could jump in and watch. The series is more focused than the original, with an overarching story. And without spoiling anything, you'll want to watch week to week. Oh, and I haven't heard many people pick up on this, but we actually worked with the same studio who did the animation for Avatar: The Last Airbender. The work they achieved for us is nothing short of extraordinary. I think you'll enjoy the first couple of episodes, but dig in. Fans aren't just prepared for where it takes you. Woo! Thank you, John. Very cool.
So I become an X-Men character? That's what happened.
Yeah. In the end, you become the X-Men.
The X-Men was us all along.
X-Men on me, baby. Heck yeah.
So that's X-Men 97. Thanks, John, for writing in as well. Christian, what is your parting gift?
Well, as my oldest and I went and saw Alkaline Trio here in Los Angeles last Friday. Ooh, them boys sound good, man. That new album is so good, and they played also all the old hits, and they sound great. I think if you're in the U.S., you've missed them, but they are going abroad starting in June. I think a lot of European dates. If you're able to, please go. They're so good. But this plays into that, a book that my sister-in-law got me that I am taking far too long to read, because as I read it, I'm like, I'm going to do a deep dive on this band's entire playlist again because I've forgotten too many of their hits. The book is Where Are Your Boys Tonight? The Oral History of Emo's Mainstream Explosion 1999 to 2008 by Chris Payne. And while it is definitely by Chris Payne, and Chris did an excellent job creating this work, the beauty of the book is that it truly is an oral history of this moment in time told by the folks in Thursday, in Taking Back Sunday, in Get Up Kids, I think are in there, Starting Line. It's like just incredible firsthand recollection of what this time was like and how these rivalries evolved and changed, and what Chris Carrabba and Dashboard talking about his experience firsthand between signing with, I think it was ended up at Vagrant and Drive Thru, and what Stephanie and Richard were doing out on the West Coast, and what the Long Island scene was at the time, and bands like Alkaline in Chicago. Absolutely incredible to sit and read, and you can, you know, hear the experiences of what was happening in the scene back in the day. And as this music is, you know, as big as it ever was again now, absolutely cannot recommend enough. Where Are Your Boys Tonight? The Oral History of Emo's Mainstream Explosion, 1999 to 2008 by Chris Payne. If you like pop punk or any of the music that came out of it, hardcore, emo, whatever, you will absolutely love reading about the experiences from the people who lived it. It's incredible.
Very cool. Very cool. My parting gift, I'm actually going to do two quick ones. The first is a friend of the show, has been on numerous times, Steven Spawn. You know him as the senior director of Able Gamers. Well, they are having their second annual Able Gamers Gala this weekend. So if you're listening to the show the first week of April, it is April 6th, Saturday, April 6th. I think I'm going to be there. I've been talking to Steven a little bit about it. So I think I'm going to be there hanging out with folks and kind of supporting the cause. And I think it's a wonderful cause. And it sounds like a really awesome event. I just wanted to get it on people's radars. If you hadn't heard about it, you can get tickets. It's a virtual party, really, a virtual gala. And you can be there in the comfort of your own home in front of your computer. So check it out. The second annual Able Gamers Gala. You may be able to hobnob and hang out with some cool people and also me, which is nice. But as far as a parting gift, I wanted to mention, I had a chance to watch both parts of the 2-part documentary that has just hit Apple TV this week about Steve Martin. I am a huge Steve Martin fan. I think he's one of the most brilliant humans that has ever walked the earth, and a true polymath and just a genius on so many levels. And it's an amazing documentary. It's a documentary done with his full cooperation. And it's 2 parts. The first part is his stand-up career, which, like, I think a lot of young people just don't even have any sense that Steve Martin was the biggest stand-up comic who ever lived. He was the first stand-up comic to do stadiums ever. And he just was the most successful person to ever do that thing in the late 70s. And then in 1980, he just stopped. He just went, no, I'm not doing it. He was at the height of his popularity and he just went, nope, no more of this. I'm only going to do movies now. And most people probably only know him for movies. But the first part of the documentary is all about his stand-up career. It's fascinating. Tons of archival footage. And the second half is about his life now and all the things he's done as a playwright and musician. He's one of the most accomplished banjo players on earth. He's an art collector. He's a cartoonist. He's like, there's nothing this guy hasn't done. He's one of the most creative people ever. And it's a fascinating look at his life and his the things that made him. And I highly recommend it. It's on Apple TV Plus. All right. If you would like to have your parting gift read on our show, send it to us. DLCfeedback@gmail.com is where you send those. That's it for this episode of DLC. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. You can always get swag for the show by going to store.dlcpod.com. We have to thank most vociferously our patrons who make the show possible. Thank you, patrons. You can become one at patreon.com/DLCpod. Our top tier patrons, our hype train patrons, well, they become video games. Those games that somehow have fallen off the radar, even though they were huge, huge games. I'm talking about, do you remember Travis? You remember the game Travis? Based on the band Travis?
I was going to say it's a travesty if you haven't.
It is a travesty.
It was right there, Jeff. Come on. Come on. I might have fumbled the rhyme at the beginning of the show, but come on. It was right there.
You remember, you remember how good this game was? It was based on, you know, it was at the era where, you know, you would base it on something and then you would do nothing. It was a band, the band Travis. Of course, we all remember their hit Side and their other hits. You know, their studio albums, Boy With No Name, Ode to J. Smith, Where You Stand, Everything at Once and 12 Memories. Remember those?
I honestly do not know if you're telling the truth right now or not.
Anyway, it was based on that band, and you didn't do anything that had anything to do with music. You just
no, Aerosmith. It's a shooter. Clearly, yes,
right? It was the Travis was you just hit people over the head with acoustic guitars.
It did really everybody gives Mortal Kombat credit for like the toasty and like all that stuff. But Travis, when you would get a really good hit and like all the strings would wonk off the guitar, it would just go travesty. Yeah. It was incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
Because while you got the kill, all your strings broke. And that was the travesty. It's hard to restring a guitar.
You didn't really kill people so much as just infuse them with sort of a alt rock malaise, you know. They'd be like, I'm gonna kill you with this knife, and you whack them with a Travis, and they'd be like, or maybe I'll just sit down and think about it.
I'm working 80 hours a week all day every I guess I'm gonna wear this flannel and think about my life. How did I get here?
Still a great game though, man.
Incredibly. I think we need more games like it. We always talk about games that the core gameplay loop is not violence. Yeah, Aerosmith, you were shooting CDs, but you were still shooting. But in Travis, you were bringing upon introspection, you know?
Yeah, you really were. You really were.
And the physics of the flannels tied around waists when you hit people too, like it was like you could see the flow of the flannel tied around the person's waist. It was just incredible. Yeah.
Just Hold like up. nobody remembers that band. Nobody remembers this game. It's really a shame because both.
It's really a what?
Shame.
It's a travesty. It's right there.
Hey, that also brings us to the other game I wanted to talk about this week. Do you remember Jenny?
I remember Jenny so well that for years I thought the Aerosmith song Janie's Got a Gun was Jenny's Got a Gun. That seems
really short-sighted of you. You know, that's.
I think it's because of the game you know, dual wielding is so commonplace now. And everybody made such a big thing about it with, was it Halo 2? You could dual wield. And I was like, well, that's great. But in my head, it was always Jenny's got a gun. Yeah. Now she's got two. Like that was always the next step.
The other thing that was so ahead of its time about that shooter, Jenny, was, you know, now where you have survival games, so common, you know, where you have to cut down trees and build up your technology till you get to the point where you can, you know, power things. Back then, your gun, most games, your gun just worked, and you didn't even need to plug them into the Jenny. You know.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But in Jenny, you had to generate your own power. You know, to power your entire arsenal, and it was like I'm turning on the Jenny. And then now I'm unable to shoot my plasma rifle, you know what I'm saying?
Where I really thought you were going on that long walk about survival games is I really thought you were going to say, you know, survival games, you're out in the woods all the time. But in Jenny, you were just from the block. And that is where.
That would have been better. That probably would have been more of a
that
payoff.
Is where you, and you had to power the block with your Jenny Raider.
With your Jenny. Yeah. It's, you know, you,
which,
you
were.
I think the reason that game didn't take off is because you couldn't take off, right? You were so tied. The extension cord only went so long, and the levels felt short because you're like, I'm 6 feet away and I've defeated all the enemies.
and seriously, if our listeners take anything away from the, you know, now 11th year we're on this show, anything I've ever said, any review I've ever given, any opinion, please know that I say this with the utmost seriousness. Everyone that owns one calls a generator Jenny. That is just, yes, it's what they're called.
That's
like,
what
you might not
called.
Know that because you don't have one, but as someone who has,
why yeah. would you?
Why would
you
know?
Only if you've ever played that game and or owned a Jenny.
Everybody knows it.
That's right.
Everybody knows it. Which is why there was that famous line of generators branded after Forrest Gump. Like, people were Jenny. Confused, but not me.
Yeah. Remember that? Remember? Do you remember watching those commercials as a kid where it's like, do you ever face power outages? Do you want to protect your family? Here's Tom Hanks to tell you what you should buy next. Well, I'd want a Jenny.
Look, Tom Hanks, great actor, renowned.
Total shill.
But the legacy of Forrest Gump, no one knows the movie. People know Bubba Gump's Shrimp House.
That's right.
And Jenny
and
Generators.
Jenny like, brand Generators. I'm not a smart man, but I know what independent power is. Anyway, great video game. And great hype train level patrons. Thank you for supporting the show at such a high level. We are in your debt and in so grateful. If you'd like to become a Hype Train patron and have your name turned into a video game, go to patreon.com/DLCpod. All right. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.